Blog Talk Radio.
I was toting my pack along the dusty Winnemucca Road, when along came a semi with a high-end canvas-covered load. If you're going to Winnemucca, Mac, with me you can ride. And so I climbed into the cab and then I settled down inside. He asked me if I'd seen a road with so much dust and sand, and I said, listen, I've traveled every road in this here land. I've been everywhere, man. I've been everywhere, man. Across the deserts bare, man. I breathe the mountain air, man. Of travel I've had my share, man. I've been everywhere. I've been to Reno, Chicago, Fargo, Minnesota, Buffalo, Toronto, Winslow, Sarasota, Wichita, Tulsa, Ottawa, Oklahoma, Tampa, Panama, Mattawa, La Paloma, Bangor, Baltimore, Salvador, Amarillo, Tocopilla, Barranquilla, and Fidel. I'm a killer. I've been everywhere, man. I've been everywhere, man. Across the desert, bare, man. I breathe the mountain air, man. Travel, I've had my share, man. I've been everywhere. I've been to Boston, Charleston, Dayton, Louisiana, Washington, Houston, Kingston, Texas, County, Monterey.
It's time for the next edition of the Riveting Jumble Justice Radio Show, broadcast worldwide on Blog Talk Radio. Turn up your speakers and listen closely, since you may be asked questions later. Keep your phone handy, since we encourage you to call in your comments to the host and guests on today's show. The listener call-in number is 347-996-5983. Once again, the number is 347-996-5983. You will also find the number on the top of the homepage for the Jumble Justice Radio Show. I am Audrey, your technical and spiritual advisor for the radio broadcast. And now, without further delay, allow me to introduce your eminently qualified and inspiring host for Jumble Justice, Professor Keith Haley.
Well, thank you very much, Audrey. One more time, you got us on, and please do not leave us tonight. This is a three-computer and one-switchboard night, so without you, Audrey, we will not be able to stay on the air and do all the things that we think we're going to try to do tonight. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the Blog Talk Radio Network and the Jumble Justice Radio Show. I'm your host, Keith Haley. Johnny Cash, we want to thank you one more time. I do add this extra caution for Johnny that we have that federal law enforcement task force now that's studying serial killers, and they're trying to see if there's any link with truck drivers across the country engaged in serial killing. I think that's a dead end for sure, but listen, every time I see one of those trucks zoom by either way, I say that truck is bringing me better living, right? That could be my next computer, a widescreen TV, a Toyota automobile. Who knows? But let's lay off the truck drivers, certainly. Johnny Cash does sing that song, by the way, from memory, where he visits more than 90 cities and states in the lyrics of that song. Try it sometime if you don't think it's stuff. Emily, thank you for being with us tonight, and I really enjoyed your comments last week. You were so kind. And Emily, of course, is the voice of the book, The Three-Bowl Diet. It's a diet plan for anybody in criminal justice or outside of it, and it's now on archive.org, archive.org. Just type in the search box at the top. You won't need any more specific address, and you will get the Three-Bowl Diet. It's about 59 minutes, audiobook. It's the only diet plan that you'll ever need. You don't need to count calories. You know, who's ever seen a calorie? How in the fact could we count them? How in the world could we count them? You don't have to add stuff up. You know, most people can't do pocket change, right? So forget it. The three-bowl diet's all you need. And one of these days, I'll tell you where I stole that idea from. Not where you would think. This is a special night also because all this time, since Mike has been on the staff of our show, that's Mike Sorrento, ladies and gentlemen, a superb internet researcher and also technician, I finally convinced him to try a little Tabasco sauce in his coffee, and he's doing it tonight. And Emily, would you move over just a little bit, because I think some of his exhales are actually burning the surface on the top of the desk. But tonight I'm doing Hungry Jack maple syrup in my coffee. If you never tried that, it's a dandy little treat. Anyway, the purpose of our show, back to reality and more serious things, who discuss news issues and events and developments in the always difficult and sometimes humorous practice of criminal justice. Our first news story tonight is a little bit humorous, although it involves bank robbery. I think we did bank robbery last week, too. Our show is dedicated to these energetic and tireless professional court corrections, juvenile justice, and police personnel who protect us and serve us throughout the United States and indeed the world. And what we try to do in this show is look inside of criminal justice practice and also take a close-up look at its professionals. Tonight will be a little different idea in terms of what we're doing in terms of the show. We're going to study, take a look at the 2008, among other things, annual report from the Attorney General's office here in the state of Ohio concerning the concealed handgun license. Each year, the Attorney General, I'm sure, is required by law, administrative law, to make an annual report, and he's done one. I think you'll find some of the statistics very important. And we have a little staged interview, not in person, with Wayne LaPierre, the leader of the National Rifle Association. Of course, the NRA is having their annual meeting, the 2009 meeting in Phoenix, Arizona, here starting, I think, maybe tomorrow, if it's not already started already. So he has some comments to say about guns and firearms and all that business. And I do have a book, by the way, autographed by Wayne LaPierre, where it says that he's a grateful student, and he gives me that he gave me an autographed copy of his book, Guns, Freedom, and something else. What is the title? Yeah, it's Guns, Crime, and Freedom. Yes, very fine book on the issue of protecting America's freedom, and it goes to the heart of the Second Amendment in the United States. But we're on Blog Talk Radio, and it's Leading Edge Technology. I saw Alan Levy this morning with his technology shows on. You should really try to catch that sometime in the morning. I think it's 8 or 9 o'clock, if I'm not mistaken. And he's the CEO of BTR and the genius behind this outstanding medium that now has literally thousands of shows, many, many famous people. If you go through the show list on blogtalkradio.com, you will see all the different people that have Brian Lamb, the founder of C-SPAN. He has his own show on there now, and I think I mentioned again 2 weeks in a row that Chris Simcox, the founder of the Minutemen, who's running for Congress, or running for the Senate against John McCain in Arizona, has his own show on there too. And Blog Talk Radio is one of the top 100 websites in the world when you think of how many are there. A million? Who knows? More than that. It's one of the top 100 in terms of hits and use. So stay tuned to the Blog Talk Radio Network. And you know what? You can get your own show. Any person, any organization, any interest group that wants to can sign up in a matter of minutes at no cost. You can broadcast your show live and streaming audio worldwide over the Internet to an unlimited number of listeners. And yes, once again, it's absolutely free. So please do that if you haven't done it. The shows are archived almost immediately after broadcast. So if you would want to use some of our shows or any of the folks' shows, you can play those back for maybe college or high school classes or focus groups or something like that. Tonight's show, we're going to talk a little bit about the news, but our feature topic is going to be the concealed handgun law and the annual report in the state of Ohio on that law in the state of Ohio. And I think you'll find, again, some of that will be interesting to you if you've not thought about that. We're not fixated on guns on this show, but guns continue to be a news issue, doesn't it? It comes up in all kinds of talk radio on both sides of the political spectrum. So we're going to deal with this annual report tonight and a couple other items that have to do with that. What you're doing, you're listening either on your cell phone. Few people do that, but some have when they've been in remote locations. You're on your computer. You can call in to the call-in number during the news portion of the show and or anytime, really, tonight. That's 347-996-5983. It's 347-996-5983. And we'll be glad to speak with you and do some discussion. Now, last week we broke a record. I mean, we did something we'd never done before. Audrey, you did it. Audrey had a smart blonde joke. Tonight, I think we're back to the norm. Audrey has a blonde joke for us to listen to tonight, and Audrey, you all set with this one? This one's, you said it's out of season a little bit. We don't care. This one, ladies and gentlemen, is about football. Audrey, go ahead.
Professor Haley, tonight's blonde joke is slightly out of season since 'tis about football, but I believe our listeners will still enjoy it. What do you think of this one? Emily and Mike enjoyed it. A guy took his blonde girlfriend to her first football game. They had great seats right at the 50-yard line. It was exciting too, a real nail-biter. After the game, he asked her if she had a good time. Oh, I really liked it, she replied, especially the tight pants and all the big muscles, but I just couldn't understand why they were all killing each other over 25 cents. Dumbfounded, her date asked, what do you mean? Well, they flipped a coin, one team got it, and then for the rest of the game, all they kept screaming was get the quarterback. Get the quarterback. I'm like, hello, it's only 25 cents.
All right, get the quarterback. That's a good one. That's a keeper. And Audrey, you know what we're scheduled for. We're going to be taking your blonde jokes, and we're going to give this book an outstanding title, and we are going to collect all of your jokes from November of 2006 and put those together in a book. And I think we're talking about a bestseller here on Amazon, Amazon.com. So, ladies and gentlemen, you stand by for that. That may transpire by the end of this summer. Ladies and gentlemen, a much more serious note. The Iowa Coalition Against Firearms has a public service announcement that I'm sure they're pleased to have us play. And this is an announcement directed toward gangbangers and street thugs who go out committing street crimes with handguns. And I think the message here to these criminals who could be good citizens if they would just lay down their guns to turn in their firearms and change their way of life. So, Ohio Coalition, go ahead.
Carrying concealed handguns in Ohio? It's a deadly idea. A message from the Ohio Coalition Against Gun Violence.
Well, Ohio Coalition, that certainly is a deadly idea. So, ladies and gentlemen, we're going to rush through the news here a little bit tonight, so we can get to some other things on the show, some other items. And I thought this was kind of interesting in terms of bank robbery is never funny. It's serious business, and quite frankly, the FBI is superb at investigating these. And you're likely to be caught if you do, two or three of these. If you happen to get away with those, you're going to be caught. But this bank robbery took place in Hamburg, Germany. And the police are looking for a crook who got away clean with more than about 10,000 pounds, we're using British currency here, after robbing a bank dressed as a little old lady. And I guess the point of the story is he was not a little old lady. He says he shuffled into the bank in Hamburg, Germany. He had on a headscarf and had on some thick glasses and long coat, and then he pulls a gun on the cashier. When he takes off, more than 100 police officers took part in this, what they call it, this chaotic citywide search for the cross-dressing blogger, and arrested five real-life old ladies as suspects before letting them go. They actually arrested five elderly old ladies before they let them go. Police spokesman said the cashier said they saw a smiling old lady come in up to the cash desk, but then suddenly she whipped out a gun, roared in a deep male voice to hand over the cash, and then quickly fled the bank as fast as an Olympic athlete, one of the witnesses said. A lot of these bankers just put a scarf over their head to hide their face, but this particular disguise was very well thought out, witnesses say, and it made catching him a little bit harder. Wouldn't you be terribly frightened if you were one of the five elderly ladies that got stopped in this regard? Wow, that is something. This is something I thought, I think I'll save this one for a moment, but somebody sent me a list of reasons why people should own a firearm. You've probably heard of things like that. But this is a very sad thing. In Oakland, California, street thugs beat to death a 97-year-old woman And this is follows a rash of what they would call Bay Area crimes involving the elderly as victims. Generally, the elderly are not victims. Most people, well, I don't know what people think, but sometimes I've heard people express the idea that the elderly are more often victims of crime. They're usually not. You know, they're home at night, they're in bed, their doors are locked. Sometimes they got an alarm, a dog, sometimes a firearm. But this woman, her body was found in her condominium in the quiet Adams Point neighborhood near Lake Merritt. And this is in Oakland, California. Acquaintances described her as independent and active, a widow who attended weekly dance exercise classes, and she still drove her Chevrolet Caprice after renewing her license just a few months ago. No arrests have been made, but the police out there are saying, you know, gee, how could something like this happen? And what kind of person is actually would actually engage in something like this? I hope they're caught, and I hope they do a long time in prison, and we don't give them any good time. They certainly didn't give her any. This is something unusual out of Imperial, California. Now, most people know what the Boy Scouts are, the Girl Scouts, and when you get too old for the Boy Scouts, I think at age 18, don't quote me on this, but you can become an Explorer Scout. And the Explorers have had affiliate programs with police departments all over the United States for a long time. And sometimes, in fact, I've had students in the Dallas area. I didn't even know about this, actually, until I moved to Texas, but I've had students that were in Explorers, and I said, you know, they were in the Scouts, and I'm wondering, gee, they're 20 years old or something, how can they still be in the Scouts? But I think in Explorer you can be up to age 21. And anyway, sometimes police departments, and the one in Dallas is very well run, but sometimes police departments will recruit from these ranks as the person becomes 20, 21 years of age. They know they've had a good look at the police department, the police department's had a good look at them, so why not try it? But this is an Explorer program run with the Border Patrol. And it says 10 minutes into an errant mayhem in this town near the Mexican border, and the gunman, a disgruntled Iraq war veteran, has already taken out two people, one slumped in his desk, the other covered in blood. The responding officers are 8 teenage boys and girls. The youngest is 14. They face a tripwire, a thin cloud of poisonous gas, and loud shots. Bam, bam, right? Fired from a flimsy wall. They move quickly with pellet guns drawn and masks affixed. In other words, what the Border Patrol was doing, they're having this Explorer Scout group, maybe you can be 14 as an Explorer Scout, because this one was, but they're having them all dress up and respond to terrorism type of incidents and other things that they might, encounter if they were Border Patrol agents. They're talking about, you know, cases where death on college campuses, responding to that, active shooters, type of things that very sophisticated police agents would become involved in. I have to think about this a little while. You know, wait a minute. Okay. I should check in my desk drawer to see if there was a terrorist in there. But, you know, probabilities as they are, you're not likely to run into a terrorist, but I'm not so sure. Whatever happened to study at the plants and hiking and, you know, canoeing and things like that? I know that sounds very old-fashioned, but, you know, to switch the whole scouting program over to this this terrorism preparedness business, I don't know. There are about 2,000 of these Explorer posts around the country, they're saying, in this news article. Sometimes they've gotten in trouble. There have been cases where some police departments have had sexual harassment complaints filed against them, when, I guess, I'm assuming female officers, you know, are part of the Explorers, and something happens there between who they're working with and that type of thing. They're restricted age 14 to 21, and the students have to have a C average in class. He did say there's a little wiggle room. He says, I will take them at 13, says Deputy Lowenthal, and he's the guy that's in charge of it. Anyway, what do you think? Should the Explorer Scouts and Boy Scouts and Girl Scouts, you know, that age, be involved in terrorist response and preparation? I'm not sure personally. You know, what's wrong with learning something about the birds and the flora and the fauna, the water, et cetera. There's kind of an interesting news story too. I thought was interesting in Oklahoma, New Mexico. I know about Oklahoma. In Oklahoma and New Mexico, a bunch of cockfighters in New Mexico filed a federal lawsuit seeking $77 million, claiming that their civil rights were violated in the state's enforcement of a 2007 law that bans the practice of cockfighting. I've never seen a cockfight, but I've seen pictures of it. It's a brutal activity in terms of what happens, and these are fierce little birds are trained up that way. And they filed this case on Tuesday, and they want to challenge the authorities who they say did not have probable cause to make the arrest and then euthanize the roosters during the raid at New Mexico farms. And I'm sure it's like most of these little groups that do this, they sort of spread it out across more than one farm in terms of the raising and training of these birds. And I remember a sheriff in Oklahoma got fired for actually attending cockfights. I think he was a North Texas sheriff, and he went to Oklahoma to see one of these, and he got fired. What they did after they made the raid, they collected 700 birds, then they euthanized them, and in other words, put them to death, put them to sleep, and kind of an odd event. I'm not sure how long I could get interested in watching cockfighting, but it must be somebody's suit. I don't think I talked about this last week. It's dated May 7th, but I think I got it after we had our show. But if I did, it's still an interesting. If I talked about it last week, it's still an interesting issue. What about this? Wisconsin upholds the GPS tracking by police, and what they're talking about here is that Wisconsin police can attach a GPS system to your car to secretly track anybody's movements without obtaining a search warrant or a court order. And the appeals court upheld that on Thursday. So that means literally, I assume this police would not randomly go out and pick people to do this. They would have certainly suspicion, which is pretty low on the proof continuum, but they would be sticking some device on your automobile that you don't know about. I don't know if it says they're talking about entering private property, but I suppose they are. And they would put this on your car, and then they'd be able to follow wherever you go in that city, state, etc. It says this means the ACLU, of course, is involved in this, and they say the police are seemingly free to secretly track anyone's public movements with a GPS device. So if they can do it with a car, can they stick it, inside your jacket or something like that? Who knows? I don't know how small these things they actually get. But one of these characters was stalking women, and I have another news story about in some of these other places where they had actually used these against stalkers, pretty good idea, I suppose. But the ACLU of Wisconsin, they do not like this. They say that goes beyond observing them in public, and it should require a warrant. What do you think? I think, personally, my view is about the same thing. If you're going to do something like that, particularly enter somebody's private property or encounter it, and then stick something on it, that seems like that ought to be something that requires a court order. But one of the chiefs of police there from the Chiefs Association, he's the president. He says other departments use it to track drug dealers, burglars, and stalkers. State already requires the Department of Corrections to track dangerous sex offenders this way. And that seems like a pretty good thing. Because in all these circumstances where something goes off, I guess you could sort of liven this up a little bit for the sex offenders, maybe also induce electric shock when they, get someplace where they shouldn't be, or you have some idea they're doing something they shouldn't be. You know, if they take that trench coat off, then maybe give them a little zap and train them back to the way they should go. But anyway, that's an interesting story, and I think this is only the beginning. We're going to see more and more of this business in terms of electronic monitoring of people. It's like it's a road we can't turn back from. And we've already done a couple of shows, only one show on spy chips. If you haven't read Catherine Albrecht's book, Spy Chips, please do that. Go to spychips.com. It's a very interesting book, and you'll find out some of the things that you're facing right now. Last news story, our virtual fence that's going to save our border, going to protect our border and stop the smuggling and the influx of illegal immigrants in the United States is finally going to start. It's been 3 years, and the construction began this week on a virtual fence aimed at stopping illegal immigration and smuggling on the Mexican border. The first phase of this, are you sitting down? $6.7 billion project. The network of towers rigged with cameras and sensors and communications equipment. It'll cover about 23 miles, about 23 miles south of Tucson. I know that area well. That's where I went down and did a study and went out on patrol with the Minutemen. Within 5 years, officials said Friday, the fence is expected to extend along the entire 2,000-mile border, except for some 200 miles in the Big Bend National Park area in Texas, a stretch that will be addressed later. I think they've got something, a wildlife issue or something there in that particular part of the country. So, you know, it'll be interesting to see. Texas had that Texas Border Watch site up once where they were using surveillance cameras and letting people monitor. You could actually call in and report violations. And I don't know how many people they caught, but they decided that wasn't their thing. And they closed that site down. I think the website is still up there, and they just sort of say thank you, and we'll get back with you. We'll get back later. So anyway, we'll see what happens with the virtual fence. Illegal immigration has slowed a little bit. I'm hearing from at least from a couple news stories that say that. Some of that has to do with the economy, and I would hope some of it has to do with a little stronger control on the border. So anyway, it's interesting. Let me give you a little comment here about some of these reasons for carrying a gun before we get to the 2008 report on Ohio. I thought these were kind of to the point in a lot of ways. I don't know. I think the author of this is anonymous, but it was sent to me by a strong patriot here in the United States. I guess you're still allowed to be a patriot, aren't you? He says, his old grandpa said to me, son, there comes a time in every man's life when he stops busting his knuckles and starts busting caps. Usually it's when he's become too old, to take a whooping. He says, I don't carry a gun to kill people. I carry a gun to keep from being killed. I don't carry a gun to scare people. I carry a gun because sometimes the world can be a scary place. I don't carry a gun because I'm paranoid. I carry a gun because there are real threats in the world. I don't carry a gun because I'm evil. I carry a gun because I've lived long enough to see the evil in the world. I don't carry a gun because I hate the government. I carry a gun because I understand the limitations of government. I don't carry a gun because I'm angry. I carry a gun so that I don't have to spend the rest of my life hating myself for failing to be prepared. I've actually talked to a couple people in that circumstance. Of course, if you've read my book With Liberty and Guns for All, that book was motivated actually by two of my friends who were murdered. I say that probably too much on the show, but I still think about them. I don't carry a gun because I want to shoot someone. I carry a gun because I want to die at a ripe old age in my bed and not on a sidewalk somewhere tomorrow afternoon. I don't carry a gun because I'm a cowboy. I carry a gun because when I die and go to heaven, I want to be a cowboy. I don't carry a gun to make me feel like a man. I carry a gun because men know how to take care of themselves and the ones they love. I don't carry a gun because I feel inadequate. I carry it because I feel unarmed and facing three armed thugs. I am inadequate. I don't carry a gun because I love it. I carry a gun because I love life, and it makes it more meaningful, and the people who make it meaningful to me. Personally, I carry a gun because I'm too young to die and too old to take that ass. Whoop it. Excuse me. Interesting. But he goes on, talks about the writer here goes on, talks about gun history in Turkey, Germany, China, Guatemala, Uganda, Cambodia. Says defenseless people rounded up and exterminated in the 20th century because of gun control. They put that figure at about 56 million people. Well, ladies and gentlemen, I think what we're going to do now, before I'll consider this as part of the news, before you take a look at that in-depth report that Ohio did on its concealed handgun law, and then take a little look at the handgun in terms of the handbook, in terms of the up-to-date handbook in terms of places the gun can't be carried. Some of those are debatable, and also the circumstances under which you can carry the handgun in the car. And when we had Sheriff Rodenberg on the show several months ago, talked about this, and he's really up on that issue, and of course wants his officers to stay up on it also. But let's see if we can take a look here and get a little look at this interview. By the way, if you're interested in this, I don't spend much time on it myself, but it, in fact, they've just upgraded it. The NRA's site, and it is real simple to find, it's NRA.com. If you look at their NRA news site, they are going through a major upgrading and substantial change on that site. You're going to find daily programs that are on there. One of the guys that's on there is Ed Head, and he's head of the Gunsight Training Center, probably one of the most sophisticated training centers in the nation. That's in Phoenix, Arizona, I believe. Then Jenny Simona, she's a commentator on there, a great news commentator. In fact, we're going to hear her say something right now as she does a little interview with Wayne LaPierre today, or maybe last night, right before the 2009 annual meeting. So we're going to do a little switch here with computers, so stand by and let's listen to Jenny interview Wayne LaPierre. But take a look at that NRA site and take a look at the news, because it is a massive repository of data and information about firearms issues and the law in the United States.
Arizona, and what a privilege as always to be joined by Wayne LaPierre. Wayne, what an exciting time. Tomorrow kicks off with the celebration of American values, and that really does summarize what this is all about, doesn't it?
Yeah, it really is. I mean, when you look at what NRA is about, NRA is about this great American freedom we have in the Bill of Rights, separates the United States from every other country in the world, and people want to not only defend it, but they enjoy participating in all the recreational aspects of firearms ownership.
And you see the turnout. They're expecting some 50,000, more than 50,000 people. And again, that speaks to what makes the NRA what it is. It's the grassroots, the moms and the pops and the families that show up here.
Yeah, I mean, what NRA is, we're in the heart of the American public. I value my freedom. I value organizations defend my freedom. And that's why I joined the National Rifle Association. And that's why we labeled this convention a celebration of American freedom and values.
What is your message to the crowd here about what we are in for with an Obama administration, the concerns that so many people have who never even really looked at their Second Amendment as something that they were going to go out and purchase firearms right away, but that's what you're seeing them do because they are so concerned about the future?
Well, I mean, my message is stay ready. I heard Dianne Feinstein, and as I'm sure supporters of the Second Amendment and freedom all over the country did. She said, I'll pick my time, I'll pick my place to attack this freedom. They know an attack's coming, and we're going to be there to defeat it when it comes, joined by millions and millions of the American public that are saying, I will protect my freedom.
And we've talked to people out there. We've talked to sheriffs up and down the border, the Mexican border, who say, you know what, we have never seen our individual freedoms at stake, threatened the way they are right now.
Well, I mean, what you clearly have is you have a growing trend to try to take American culture and bend it to some world standard of behavior. And that is a critical step down the path of an abandonment of our American way of life. I mean, our American freedom cannot and will not bend to the will of a world that wants a lesser standard of freedom. I mean, the idea of coming in and touching our Bill of Rights, whether it's speech or religion or right to own a firearm, is something the NRA and the American public will not stand for. I mean, I think it's preposterous of the Mexican government to somehow think that by diminishing American Second Amendment freedom, you're going to have any impact on these drug criminal cartels that rape, rob, kill, murder, have unlimited money, and break every law known to man.
And yet you have a White House, you have members of Congress, you have Senator Dianne Feinstein, as you were just talking about, you know, going to Mexico, apologizing for our freedoms as if we are to blame for what we're seeing over there. And as you were saying, she said when the time is right, she'll move forward with it. But yesterday, even at the White House, when the press secretary was asked, if Congress sends you an assault weapons ban, they didn't really answer it. So what do you say to the public about that? Be ready is what you were saying.
I say stay ready and be ready. I mean, but our founding fathers knew that. I mean, these freedoms we have are just words on a piece of parchment paper, and we have to go out and defend them every single day. And that's what I love about the NRA. The NRA plants its flag, it fights on principle, and the NRA has learned, and we've learned, that if you fight for freedom, you're going to have more of it. And that's what I love about this institution.
And also, when times get tough, boy, they sure rally to the cause.
Well, like always. I mean, I'm showing a video tomorrow of 1812 when the mightiest army and navy in the world, the British Army and Navy, sailed into Baltimore Harbor, and 10,000 country boy sharpshooters came out of the hills and defeated the mightiest army in the world at that time. I mean, that's Americans standing in for their freedom. And we're doing it today in a different way here, by coming out and saying that we're not going to let these politicians with high visibility access to the media somehow pass laws to say I cannot own a firearm in this country. I have my rights. That's the Second Amendment, and that's what the NRA stands for.
And as you've always said, punish the criminal, don't punish the law-abiding.
Oh, you want to make cities safe, put the NRA crime program in every city of America, which is Project Exile. Every time you catch a drug dealer with a gun, felon with a gun, violent criminal with a gun, gang member with a gun, prosecute him, take him off the streets, put him in jail. You could cut crime in every city of the country by doing that.
And it's got to make you feel good when the mayor of Phoenix says, you know, we're so proud to have the NRA here because of who they are and what they stand for.
We're a microcosm of America. I mean, I say all the time, I mean, take any slice of apple pie, you'll find NRA in your neighborhood. I mean, there's not a citizen in this country who's not living with NRA members on their block. We're hardworking, tax-paying Americans that believe in freedom, and that's what this organization's about, and that's what I love about it. I mean, our strength doesn't come from the building in Washington. It doesn't even come from any of us that work on this day in, day out. It's one by one people all over this country that have this desire to save this freedom in their hearts, and that's the strength of the National Rifle Association.
And that's what this celebration is all about. And thanks for taking the time to be with us.
Thanks a lot.
All righty.
Well, Wayne Lupp here is an excellent writer also, and his book, Guns, Crime, and Freedom, is a 1994 book, but perhaps he's updated it, I don't know, but he's very articulate with words and has a way of saying things. And I thought some of those comments tonight were just on point in terms of one of those, in terms of making us adjust to the standards of the world and changing our culture in order that we can fit in every sector and every way with the culture of the world. And I'm not sure that's why we have a country, a separate country, in order that we fit in with everybody in every way. And I think the philanthropy and the kind-heartedness of the American people, I think we don't have to make our case for that. Nobody gives more in the world than we do. And I don't know, but it's good. I think he said that 50,000 people are actually attending the convention in Phoenix this week. That's a lot of people. And I'm not sure exactly sure how many people belong to the National Rifle Association, but I'm sure it's a large number. All right, let's go ahead and take a look at this Ohio Right to Carry annual report, and it's a very interesting report. And some of the data on it, I think that you'll be interested in hearing about. soon as I can get it up here on the screen. Mike, thank you very much. And this is called, the actual report is called Ohio's Concealed Handgun Law, 2008 annual report dated March 1, 2009. And you can go right to, you can Google it and just get Ohio's Concealed Handgun Law, and it will go right to the Ohio Attorney General's site. And it's a PDF document that you can download and study yourself. It's a 31-page document. And starts out generally telling you, since Ohio got its law, how many people have gone and gotten handgun licenses. The law started in 2004, and in 2004, 45,497, I know it's hard to hear data on the radio and think much about it, but I'll do it anyway and try to be slow about it. But in 2004, 45,497 people were issued. This is a table that talks about the licenses issued, were issued concealed carry handgun licenses in the state of Ohio. 45,000 the first year. Of course, that's the largest year. Usually that happens in every state. It takes a little while for it to get rolling, but people get it because they think, well, maybe it's going to disappear shortly. Ohio's total, by the way, right now is about 142,732. Well, 142,732 people have a CCW or a concealed carry license here in the state of Ohio. So from 2004, it went from 45,497. The next year, it dropped to half that, to 22,487. The next year, 2006, it was 18,781. Then you get another jump in 2007 to 22,103 and then 33,864 in 2008. So in 2006, the middle year between 2005 and 2008, you get down to 2008, you get down to 18,000 in terms of issuance of licenses, and then that's moving its way up in 2008. We'll have to see what happens in 2009. I do know some folks that have got their license in 2009. But anyway, it says here, in calendar year, the fourth full year of Ohio's concealed handgun law, Ohio sheriffs issued 33,864 licenses. That's an increase of about 53% from the previous year and a drop of nearly 26% compared to the number of licenses issued in what they call the inaugural year in 2004. That was only, actually, that wasn't even a full year. That was April to December of 2004. And again, the total number is 142,732 permanent licenses. Now, you don't get to keep your license forever if you don't do right. And sometimes, according to the Ohio Revised Code, this is section 2923.128, sheriffs must immediately suspend the concealed handgun license upon notification that the licensee has been arrested or charged with certain offenses, or if a licensee is the subject of a protection order issued by the court. That's good to take licenses away from people that are having real serious family problems and domestic violence issues. The license may be returned to the holder if he or she is found not guilty of the charges, or the charges are dismissed. It says here it's important to note that some of these licenses that have been issued in previous years, sheriffs are not required to report the details surrounding a suspension. So that would be an interesting study. I get a graduate student involved in that to get into the details of what these expenditures or these suspensions actually are. Now, licenses can also be revoked. And in the first year, and that also is Ohio Revised Code, Section 2923.128, sheriffs can permanently revoke the license of any person who no longer meets the eligibility requirements to carry a concealed handgun. So let's look at some of that data. In 2004, the first year, between April and December, they revoked 42 licenses. 2005, it was 75. 2006 was 194. That was the peak year. Then it starts to drop again in 2007. It goes down to 171. Then in 2008, it was just 157. What are some of the reasons, or at least the major reasons, why that can happen? I bet you could guess some of those. Maybe not the first one. The first one is they move out of state. So if a person leaves the state, then of course their license is revoked. I'm not sure every state does that exactly like that, but that's the mechanism, that's the procedure here in the state of Ohio. If you move out of the state, then you can't come back in the state and carry anymore. Of course, people do expire, they die, so that's a reason to have the license revoked. It's not transferable to your next of kin, of course. Then they decided not to hold the license anymore. And I've never known anyone that's done this, but I have talked to some, one officer, I guess, actually. One police officer was telling me that some people don't like to be identified as having the CCW license, and it is a public record. Newspaper people can ask for the list from a county, from the, I guess from the sheriff, and it's made public. Then, of course, law enforcement officers know that when they see you on the street and they run your license plate, I think they probably in virtually every state, they know that you have a CCW license. That's a safety thing for the police officer, nothing wrong with that, but some people feel encumbered by that. They feel intimidated by the fact that the officer knows they have a firearm, so they might, in fact, stop them for some legitimate reason, but still have to do a search for the firearm and that type of thing. So they don't want that, and they get away from it. Or some people may decide they simply just don't want to keep up with it, don't want a handgun in the house for some reason, maybe children. They've had a second thought about that. Anyway, they decide not to have the license anymore. Person is convicted or was convicted for a disqualifying type of crime. Then the subject became, they became subject to the law's restrictions on mentally ill people or people considered drug or alcohol dependent. And again, sheriffs are not required by law to report the specific reason for revocation by the Peace Officer Training Commission. I know about that Peace Officer Training Commission. I was the executive director of it for 5 years, from 86 to 1991, and in thrilling job. Now, also in the annual report are denials. In other words, some people will apply for a license, and I'm always amazed at the people that come down and, you know, I just get out of prison. Can I get a concealed handgun license? I suppose that has actually happened, or some prisoner moved in from another state, maybe have a need for a gun, not on the criminal side, but for protection. But they can't get one. So anyway, the first year in 2004, 436 denials. So sometimes the law enforcement community and the proponents and authors of these bills were accused of, you know, making up a bill that anybody could get the license. Well, that's not true. The first year we had 436, 2004 denied, 2005, 427. This is the whole state of Ohio now. 2006, 384. Then it goes up again in 2007 to 434. Then in 2008, it's up to all-time high of 468. So we have more people coming down applying for license who aren't meeting the criteria. The sheriff can deny an application to any person who fails to meet the eligibility requirements. And that's in Ohio Revised Code 2923.125 for the regular license. And then there is a temporary emergency license. You can go down and get a license from your local sheriff. If you can show that your life is in threat, and if you go to the right to carry handbook, it talks about that. That type of criteria, which is also on the Attorney General's site, and it's a free download. So in 2008, sheriff denied 465 applications for licenses. This is a 7% increase from 2007. When you get an Ohio right to carry license, as is the case in virtually every other state, the Attorney General by law is required to work out reciprocal agreements with other states in the United States. In other words, if you happen to be an Ohio concealed handgun license holder, then you also have permission legal authority to carry that firearm concealed in other states. And Ohio has reciprocal agreements with these states: Alaska, Arizona, Arkansas, Delaware, Florida, Idaho, Kentucky, stay with me, it's not a long list, Michigan, Missouri, North Carolina, Oklahoma, South Carolina, Tennessee, Utah, Virginia, Washington, West Virginia, and Wyoming. And one of the states that, that has perhaps the largest number of concealed carry holders, I think they would be Texas, and we don't have a reciprocal agreement with Texas. And I think when you read the Texas law, in fact, it was the one that they tried to introduce into Congress, probably still lying around up there somewhere. It's the one that they introduced in Congress and to get a national right to carry law. And Texas, as far as all the ones that I've seen, is the most stringent set of requirements. You're required to go through like 5 or 6 different type of background checks, even paying your taxes. Texas, you better pay your taxes. They don't have a state income tax, but if you don't pay property taxes or something like that, you're in trouble. But the qualifications are very stringent in Texas, and you have to go to the class, of course, and take a written exam, which we do in Ohio, but I'm not sure how stringent that is. But then the performance test is very difficult in Texas. If you've ever seen my study, I'll send it to you if you'd be interested. I wrote the study that's in the book, With Liberty and Guns for All. It's entitled The Politics of Packin', A Political Analysis of the Texas Right to Carry Law. And I happened to be in Texas when Texas was passing its law, and Ann Richards was running for governor against George Bush. And George Bush said that he would sign that right to carry law the minute it hit his desk, and he did. And Ann Richards was against that. And the votes changed a little bit because of that. I can't understand. Ann Richards and George Bush weren't that different, actually, although she had some classic lines about him. Well, enough about Texas politics. But we don't have a reciprocal agreement. It's funny, we have a reciprocal agreement with Oklahoma, and Oklahoma has a reciprocal agreement with Texas, but we don't have one with Texas. And I'm sure there are other versions of that in this list, or renditions of that in this list also. Now, let me take a look at the here's a long list of mental incompetencies where people are mentally incompetent. The state that the county that leads that is Hamilton County with 5,316. These are mental incompetency reports where the mental health people are supposed to make these reports. So that doesn't mean that all those went down and applied for licenses. Then they have a total list here. If you're interested in it, I'm certainly not going to read these off, but all counties in the state of Ohio and the number of license issues renewed, suspended, revoked, denied, and those that are in process. So that's an interesting list too. A lot of data. Looks like the Peace Officer Training Commission is doing a good job of collecting all that. Now let's take a look at the booklet that tell us a little bit about some of the more controversial areas relative to these right to carry laws. And I think I'll just probably have time to go through one of these lists. But you know, folks, that it was a very controversial in the state of Ohio when the law first was passed in 2004. You could only carry the gun wearing it exposed. In other words, you couldn't have a jacket on. It had to be holstered and exposed so that when the officer walked up to the car, he could see your shoulder holster and he could see the firearm. And of course, so could everybody else in the Kroger's parking lot or wherever. Couldn't wear a coat. Or it had to be locked in a glove box or some container, locked. And most carjackers won't wait for you to unlock it. Now, or it had to be mounted on a very strange device on the dashboard that was in full view. So you can imagine your neighbors, friends, other people, strangers, when you go to the movie theater and you're parked out there, here's this gun up on the, or they see you take the gun out of this locked rack and put it away. So the advocates here in the state of Ohio fought for that for a long time, and they finally got it to the point now where it doesn't, it doesn't have to be exposed like that. In fact, it doesn't have to be locked up. It has to be in some type of, you can carry it concealed on your person, but it can also be in some type of zip, snap, whatever type of container, as long as it has to be opened before you can get the gun. In other words, it can't be lying on the seat or laying on the seat. Here are some places where you can't carry. This also is controversial in many regards. People know the state of Utah, that college students can carry them in class, concealed. And Virginia and some other states have brought that up, particularly after the Virginia Tech shooting. I think Utah is still the only state that that actually permits that. But we've had no bloodbaths on college campuses as a result of that. Some professors may get a little bit worried around exam time or near the end of the course where grades may not be as high as they should be, but that's not funny, actually. But anyway, here's some places you can't carry it if you would imagine that you could. Police stations, sheriff's offices, highway patrol posts, premises controlled by the Ohio Bureau of Criminal Identification and BCI, in other words, correctional institutions or other detention facilities, that's good, airport terminals or commercial airplanes, institutions for the care of the mentally ill, courthouses or buildings in which a courthouse courtroom is located, universities, unless locked in a motor vehicle or in the process of being locked in a motor vehicle. In other words, you can be carrying it on a campus in a parking lot until you get it, if you're in the process of locking it up in a motor vehicle. Places of worship, unless the place of worship permits this otherwise. And we had the church shooting, I think it was in Fort Worth, and Texas changed their law that permitted people then to carry it in church. Child daycare centers, license D, liquor permit premises in which any person is consuming liquor, so you can't do that. Concealed firearms are banned in premises where a D permit, has been issued. You can some exceptions to that. It gets a little complicated. I won't take the time to go through that. But anyway, you can drop kids off at school and that type of thing. That's possible now under the law. That was very controversial. School safety zones, you can't carry it into things like that. But if you're dropping somebody off, that's permitted. It became such a problem. If you read my study, it became such a problem you needed a skyhook to hang this thing up because there were so many places where it was illegal. But what happens, these states sort of go overboard originally in making the restrictions when they pass the law, and some common sense prevails, and eventually some of these places are removed from the list where people would want or perhaps need concealed firearms. Well, the booklet goes on to tell what you do when the law enforcement officer shows up. I think it's a good idea to let them know that you've got the gun and keep your hands maybe up on the steering wheel. Tell them where the firearm is. Tell them that you are a CCW holder. So anyway, it's a very complicated subject in many ways, controversial in many others. It's good law. And we now know without question, based on John Lott's studies and lots of other folks now, that about 1.5 to 2 million people a year use a firearm to ward off a felon. And some of those people have literally saved their lives as a result of that. And about 90-some percent of these cases, they take out the firearm and the robber, murderer, rapist simply takes off, or the burglar to be runs away. So that's good. Well, next week, join us. Look on the course billing or the billing on Blog Talk Radio at our site for Jumbo Justice Radio and see what we're going to be doing next week. And I'm sure, thank you for joining us tonight, and I'm sure we'll meet again.
Again, don't know when, don't know when, but I know we'll meet again some sunny day. Keep smiling through, just like you always do. Till the blue skies drive the dark clouds far away.